Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with escalating tensions on campuses across America as pro-Palestinian demonstrators face off against supporters of Israel, with the charge of anti-Semitism weaponized against students expressing outrage over the war in Gaza. Joining us is Raz Siegel, a professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies and an endowed professor in the study of modern genocide at Stockton University in New Jersey. He was at the University of Pennsylvania encampment yesterday giving a talk to students on the perils of anti-Semitism at campus protests. Then we'll assess the strength of the trial underway in New York, which may end up as the only court to hold Trump accountable before the election, and speak with Dennis Aftergat, a former federal prosecutor and chief assistant city attorney in San Francisco, who has won cases of significance in the United States Supreme Court and the California Supreme Court. He currently serves as counsel to Lawyers Defending American Democracy, and he has two articles at Salon which we will discuss. SCOTUS Majority Abandons Conservative Principles to Mount Bizarre Defense of Trump's Immunity Claim, and Underestimating Alvin Bragg's Case Against Donald Trump is a Historic Mistake. Then finally, with elections underway in India, which is often referred to as the world's largest democracy, we will look into a disturbing article in today's Washington Post. An assassination plot on American soil reveals a darker side of Modi's India, and speak with Dr. Sumit Ganguly, who holds the Rabindranath Tagore Chair in Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University in Bloomington. His books include India Since 1980, India, Pakistan, and the Bomb, Debating Nuclear Stability in South Asia, and his latest book is The Oxford Handbook of India's National Security. And before we begin, I would like to thank our listener donors who keep Background Briefing independent, corporate, and commercial free without paywalls or constant fundraising by making tax-deductible donations to our nonprofit foundation, the Public Truth Media Foundation, at publictruthmedia.org or at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. As we enter this fact-free and violence-prone election year, with much of the country under the cult-like spell of a deranged demagogue spewing constant lies while inciting hatred and violence, help us continue to seek out facts and information to awaken America's silent majority before our democracy is trumped by fascism. And joining us now is Raz Siegel, a professor of the Holocaust and Genocide Studies and an endowed professor in the study of modern genocide at Stockton University in New Jersey. And yesterday he was on the campus of the University of Pennsylvania at an encampment giving a talk on the perils of anti-Semitism at protests. Welcome to Background Briefing, Raz Siegel.
Hi, Ian. Thank you for having me again.
Well, thanks for joining us. And out here in Los Angeles on Sunday, we had a demonstration on the UCLA campus where campus authorities did not bring in the police, which had been a problem at various other campuses, and particularly at Columbia. But they used sort of campus security, and they had a sort of line of bicycles with these security guys who weren't armed but had batons, sort of separating groups of pro-Palestinian students and other pro-Israel students wrapped in the Israeli flag. Not entirely sure about how many were actual students, and there's always this issue of outside agitators. But essentially what they did was they shouted at each other, and a few scuffles broke out across who broke through the barrier of bicycles. But by and large, it was very different from a lot of the other protests we've seen, and seem to be handled better, certainly, than USC, who canceled the speech from a valedictorian who was, in fact, her instructor, says she doesn't have an anti-Semitic bone in her body, and her instructor has written 10 books on the Holocaust. So I'm sure you're familiar with that, aren't you, Raz?
Yeah, absolutely. I know Wolf Gruner, and I read the excellent piece that he published in the student newspaper about this.
Right. So what's the issue here, apart from the passions on both sides, in terms of university bureaucracies and leadership? There's a mixed bag, to say the least, right?
I think it's quite clear what's at stake here. We're seeing yet another intensification of the weaponization of anti-Semitism. I mean, this is not new. This began well before 7th of October. It's actually the weaponization of anti-Semitism as a way to divert attention from Israeli policies and Israeli mass violence and military occupation of Palestinians in the West Bank and East Jerusalem and Gaza, and the siege on Gaza, and Israeli mass violence more broadly. This has been going on, this weaponization of anti-Semitism, saying that critique of Israeli policies, that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. This has a history of about 3 decades now. And we're seeing this now intensify, this discourse in a very intense form in relation to the protests on campuses across the US. So much so, actually, that we're now also seeing a discourse that we know that there's a lot of Jews among the protesters, and the protest, the encampments have organized solidarity seders, Passover seders, and Shabbat services, right? And people who are Jews, who identify as Jews in various ways, including religious people who their identity as Jews is rooted in their religious practices, are among the protesters. So we're now seeing a discourse that marks them as well. Not only actually as anti-Semites, which again is not new, right? Marking Jews as anti-Semites, but actually seeing them as not Jews, right? And I think that this is because obviously the urgent need to divert attention from an unfolding genocide in Gaza, right? Don't look at Gaza, these people are telling us, and in some cases, these people, I mean, when we think about Elise Stefanik, for example, and these kinds of people, so white supremacists and people who are themselves anti-Semites, right, are now wielding in a very cynical way this weaponized discourse of anti-Semitism. And one of their key goals is don't look at Gaza, don't look at unfolding Israeli genocide in Gaza. Now, for US universities, there's some very, the stakes are very high because, in many cases, American universities are invested their money in companies with ties to Israel, with ties to Israeli arms industries, arms and surveillance industries. And the students, one of their key demands is to disclose these ties and to divest, right, to cut ties with companies that work with Israel and that have for many years, for decades, right, been supporting and aiding and abetting Israeli mass violence and now genocide, right, since 7th of October. And I think that many US universities are, are so invested in that for so long a time that now, they're looking for any way, right, to divert attention from that, to marginalize it, not to, of course, to respond to these very legitimate demands of the students in these encampments. And therefore, we see this intensification of the discourse of anti-Semitism. And as I said, this kind of new stage now, which is actually the many Jews among the protesters, right, are now seen as not even Jews, right? And that's something that is, worth discussing in itself, actually.
But on the pro-Palestinian side, Raz Siegel, is there any evidence of support for Hamas? Because that is the accusation that they're either dupes of Hamas or support Hamas.
No, absolutely. There's zero evidence for that, for the encampments across US universities. There is some evidence, and people have talked about this, that outside people from outside these encampments, or for example, from outside of the gates of Columbia University, for example, or have come and said all kinds of things, and there's been all kinds of incidents. But the encampments themselves, and anyone who's been on these encampments, right, and talked with the students, right, and I've been at the encampment at University of Pennsylvania, as you said. I've been there with Dr. Omer Bartov in the last few days. We've had an event on the campus of University of Pennsylvania on anti-Semitism and its weaponization. And then we walked over and we spoke with the students in the encampment. Anyone who's been in the encampment knows that these allegations are nonsense, right? These students are protesting the support of their universities and of the US government of an unfolding genocide right now in Gaza, very well documented genocidal violence that can only happen because of the support of the US government and the complicity of their universities. They have very legitimate demands. They are not supporters of Hamas. They are not paid by Hamas. They're not. This is just nonsense and ridiculous, right? And again, it's meant to divert attention from what we need to be talking about, right? Which is Israeli mass violence, which is unfolding genocide in Gaza, and the support of the US and these universities. With that, right? So no, these allegations have no basis in any reality.
But of course, Raz Siegel, there is a political dimension in terms of the current presidential race, for example. Netanyahu, in effect, has got Biden in a bind. And today, of course, the Secretary of State Blinken says that the Israelis have made an incredibly generous offer to Hamas for a ceasefire. At the same time, Netanyahu is planning to invade Rafah and essentially turn Gaza into a tent city where people will, they don't have any homes to go back to. And essentially, I think the plan would be to basically let the international community have to deal with this sort of homeless population. So, what's your sense of? I mean, a lot of our analysts are talking about, well, this is sort of has echoes of the Vietnam War protests. And then, of course, then that leads you to think about what's going to happen with the Democratic Convention this year, which is being held in Chicago. And in 1968, of course, the riots in Chicago, coinciding with the Democratic Convention, were very damaging to Hubert Humphrey, and he lost to Nixon. So, how do you see that analogy and in the current situation? And in effect, can we address the presidential politics behind this? Because I don't think it's any mystery, surely, Raz, that Netanyahu would prefer to have Trump and will probably do anything he can to help bring back Trump, as will Putin and Mohammed bin Salman.
Look, I'm not sure that I'm the right person to discuss these issues. I mean, it's very clear that Biden and the Democratic Party have put themselves in a very difficult position politically here towards the upcoming elections in November. And I think for me, it raises, it raises a lot of questions of why the Democratic Party is doing what it's doing, right? I mean, why is it so clear to so many people that so many people now who tend to vote for the Democrats will now likely not vote for the Democrats, right? Because they will not be able to vote for a president that is actively for 6.5 months now supporting an unfolding genocide, right? In a very active way. So it raises questions about, why are the Democrats doing what they're doing, making the choices that they're making? Again, I'm not sure that I'm the person to discuss these issues, but I think that that we actually, this is, an opportunity to say that what we should be looking at actually is returning the gaze to these, well, to the unfolding genocide, as I said, but to these students on these campuses. And you mentioned, the protests around the Vietnam War. The students now in the encampments on US campuses are pointing the way to different kinds of politics also. Right, and we should be, we should be listening to them. We should be considering what they're saying. We should not, therefore, be immersed in this weaponized discourse that tags them as Hamas or anti-Semites or all these kinds of things. No, if we think about a future beyond the political deadlock that we clearly see in the US today, right, with the two candidates that we have, I think there's also a large consensus in US society that doesn't want Neither of them, right? If we want to think about a political future beyond the political deadlock that we're in, beyond really, I mean, and you know, between these two alternatives that neither of them is very good or appealing to most Americans, right? Then we should be looking at the students on these campuses. They're smart, they're creative, they're original, they're diverse. They are telling us, they are showing us the possibilities, the alternative for a different kind of a future, in relation, of course, to Israel and Palestine, right? But also, of course, in relation to US politics and society. And we should be listening to them and listening to them seriously and not engage in this nonsense discourse that is absolutely false.
Well, but to answer your question of why the Democrats are doing this, doesn't it have something to do with donors? And that's the same issue on campus, isn't it? Aren't university heads responding to rich donors who are upset with the change in narrative, where a lot of young Americans now don't see Israel as the victim? They see Palestine as the victim and Palestinians as the victims.
Yeah, of course. Of course, universities are responding to a lot of pressure from wealthy donors, right? Without a doubt. And this obviously is mixed with issues of ideology. It's not just a matter of money, right? But you know, but again, the pressure of donors on U.S. campuses and in U.S. politics is in large part what brought us to today, right? To everything that we're seeing around us today. I mean, to Israeli genocide in Gaza, to the fact that the American academic world is kind of collapsing into itself, right? In the way that US universities are now choosing to suppress, right, academic freedom, to suppress free speech, to turn against their students in this kind of horrendous and violent ways, to invite police into their campuses, right? And we all know that this has failed miserably in the past as well. And yet here they are repeating these mistakes. So of course, donor pressure in American academic world and in American politics, right, has brought us to where we are today, right? And which is again all the more reason. I mean, you really have to ask yourself, right? I mean, these are especially universities like Columbia University, University of Pennsylvania, incredibly wealthy universities and institutions. I am sure that they can tell a lot of these people who are putting pressure on them, okay, you can take your money and go, right? And they can do just as well without their money, actually, right? But regardless, this again to return to the students, right, and to what they're telling us about the system, that the system has failed, right? It has created a violent world. It has created a world that doesn't even adhere to its own discourses, right, about academic freedom, about free speech, about all these things that are actually at the core of US democracy, right? These people are allegedly, right, very central in the system of US democracy, but we see now that n actually not, right? So where should we be looking at? Not at the donors who brought us here, but at the students who are pointing us in different directions. And again, this is a diverse group of people, the people at the encampments, right? They're Christians, they're Muslims, they're Jews, they're Palestinians, they're Arabs, they're LGBTQ people, they're men, they're women. They are a diverse group of people, and they are demanding a different kind of present and a different kind of future.
So, just in closing, then, Raz, what you're describing is the new majority. And what we've been talking about is the tyranny of the minority, how a handful of moneyed plutocrats control our politics or influence our politics. They certainly control the Supreme Court. So, how do you see this battle lining up? Is the silent majority in this country sufficiently aroused to change America, and how can they change America if, as you say, nobody's on the, in terms of this young generation, are particularly happy with the political choices facing them?
I don't know how this will unfold and how this will work out, obviously, right? But I think, you know, I can tell you that I'm a scholar of the Jewish world. I'm an Israeli, I'm a Jew, I'm a scholar of the Jewish world, I'm a scholar of the Holocaust and a scholar of genocide, right? And there are, quite a few scholars in Holocaust and genocide studies, including Israeli Jews. I said I was just with Dr. Omer Bartov at the University of Pennsylvania, for example, right? Who are now actively supporting the encampments, right? Who are talking about this false weaponization of the discourse around anti-Semitism, which is actually also very dangerous because it exposes Jews to the real, very real anti-Semitism that we see from the right, around us. And I mentioned Holocaust and genocide studies scholars. I mentioned among them also Israelis and Jews. Because I think that one of the ways, I mean, we live in a world today with a lot of absurdities in front of our eyes. I mean, again, if you think about Elise Stefanik accusing university presidents of, creating hotbeds of anti-Semitism on their campuses, she's a white supremacist and anti-Semite. This is a crude absurdity in front of our eyes. This is just an example related to the topic that we're discussing. But of course, we live in a world with many absurdities, and we have to insist on the truth, right? We have to throw back at them constantly the truth, and that's why I say we have to continue to insist on returning our gaze to the unfolding genocide in Gaza. We have to insist to returning our gaze to the support of the U.S. government and this to the support of these campuses, to the fact that this system, right, is ruled by white supremacists and anti-Semites in many ways, right? So we have to. So one of the ways in which this will play out is actually insist on this truth, on the truth that we can actually. This is part of the absurdity, right? That we live in an era where we really have to insist on truth that are in front of our eyes, right? So we have to say no. Of course, the students in the encampments are. Supporters of Hamas or anything like that. And I invite everyone to come to the encampments and see if, Jews wearing a kippah, right, standing together with Palestinians with keffiyeh are actually hotbeds of Hamas, right? And anyone who thinks that, right, a keffiyeh is somehow an anti-Semitic image, right? These kinds of crazy, absurd ideas. So one of the ways in which this will, just to answer your question, will play out is if that we insist, including scholars like me and in my field specifically, Holocaust and genocide studies, which is so important today, right, will not relent by throwing back at these people the truth in their face. It's part of the struggle. There are many other things that obviously should happen, but insisting on the truth is so very important today.
Well, Russ Siegel, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Russ Siegel, who's a professor of Holocaust and Genocide Studies and an endowed professor in the study of modern genocide at Stockton University in New Jersey. And yesterday he was on the campus of University of Pennsylvania at the encampment giving a talk on the perils of anti-Semitism at student protests. We're going to take a brief station break and back with an assessment of the strength of the trial underway in New York, which may end up as the only court to hold Trump accountable before the election. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Dennis Aftergat, who's a former federal prosecutor and chief assistant city attorney in San Francisco, who has won cases of significance in the United States Supreme Court and the California Supreme Court. He currently serves as counsel to Lawyers Defending American Democracy, and he has two articles at Salon. Underestimating Alvin Bragg's case against Donald Trump is a historic mistake. And SCOTUS majority abandons conservative principles to mount bizarre defense of Trump's immunity claim. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dennis Aftergat.
I'm always honored to be on your show, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, Dennis. And you write in your article SCOTUS majority abandons conservative principles to mount bizarre defense of Donald Trump's immunity case, that Americans want to know before they vote if Trump is innocent or guilty of using unlawful means to intervene with the 2020 certification of Biden's election victory. We deserve the knowledge, but the Supreme Court, however, has no such care. In the stunning words of Trump appointee Justice Brett Kavanaugh, "I'm not concerned about the here and now. I'm more concerned about the future." Justice Samuel Alito said he didn't want to talk about the particular facts, but rather to talk in the abstract. And to the same effect was the statement of Trump's appointee, Justice Neil Gorsuch, who said, we're writing a decision for the ages. So how different are these Supreme Court far-right justices from the revisionists that are out there in MAGA world saying that what happened on January the 6th was no big deal, it was a love fest, beautiful people, peace and love and puka shells, and if there was anything went wrong, it was FBI plants and Antifa. I mean, aren't they on the same page as the MAGA denialists?
They're on the same page. They're on the same word. They're on the same letter. There's no difference. This is what they're doing is just a legalistic way of saying exactly the same thing. We don't want to focus on the here and now. And that's because they can't. If you focus on the real and now, you would have ruled today. There's just no question about the here and now. So they're distracting by talking about, oh, what about the problems for the future? That is the abandonment of conservative principles. The reason for that is that conservative jurisprudence says, ordinary jurisprudence says, you only decide the exact case before you. You don't decide hypotheticals. And that's what they want to do. They want to distract. So they have an excuse to send the case back for further proceedings and delay. This whole legalistic approach, Ian, is nothing more than a Trojan horse for delay.
But it's more than an abandonment of conservative principles, surely, Dennis, because what's at jeopardy here, as far as I can see, is the respect for the law and its credibility. Because when the highest court in the land makes it clear that the fix is in and that the powerful and privileged like Trump will be protected from the rule of law, what does it mean for the rule of law for the rest of us? Are we to accept the double standard where ordinary folk can go to jail if they do something wrong, but a rich and powerful real estate developer turned president, having a second run at it with the help of the Supreme Court, he can do no wrong?
You have it exactly right. The American Revolution was fought over the idea that no person is above the law. Thomas Paine wrote that in America, the law is king, not any man. Thomas Paine is not just rolling over in his grave. He is standing up and screaming at the Supreme Court, you can't do this, but they have the power and they can. And you ask the question, Ian, are we to accept it? The good news is that for now, we have the medium in which to scream ourselves that no person is above the law, not Donald Trump. And that medium is our vote in November. We have the opportunity to say to the Supreme Court, no, you don't. And we better get out there and we better get others out there to vote, because that will nullify whatever they're doing. And last point on that, Ian, as I say in the opinion piece, if we do that, whatever the court does will not be of significance, and we can vote for a Congress and a president that will do something to change this Supreme Court.
Right. But nevertheless, though, the delaying tactics, which is clearly even if they rule with knocking down Trump's absurd claims, but giving him some sort of limited immunity, the bottom line is that, one, they've already delayed the January 6th case in Washington, D.C., and they won't make a decision till late June. They took this case up on the last day. And if they remand it back to the appeals court, it's never going to be heard before the election. So that much they will have achieved. Even if Biden wins, the American people will be denied the knowledge and information about what Trump really did.
Well, Will, first of all, you've got it exactly right. If they decide this case on the last day of the term or somewhere very close, there's very little chance that the case could be tried to verdict before the election, and we will be deprived. Trump will have deprived us of important information that we need. Just same issue in the Manhattan trial, how he deprived voters of information they needed through that catch and kill scheme. That's his MO. We will be deprived before the election. But Ian, two things. If Biden wins, you said, we will not be deprived of the information ultimately because he will be tried. Maybe that's a small consolation, but we will not be deprived before the election of a verdict in the Manhattan case. And we should all be very, very grateful to Alvin Bragg that he had the courage to bring that case, because it is really strong. As I said, it's about the same ultimate thing, and that is Trump's trickery to keep people from knowing who he is before they vote.
Well, let's talk about that trial, because the irony is, of course, that it was always sort of dismissed as the weakest case, and the strongest case, of course, is the one down in Florida, where Trump's appointed a federal judge down there, Eileen Cannon, is doing everything she can to delay that. And then you've got the Supreme Court delaying the January 6th case in Washington, D.C., and you've got the district attorney in Atlanta already sort of hurting her own case. So ironically, the case in Manhattan has turned out to be the strongest. Would you agree?
Well, it's turned out to be the most important because it's the one that's going to be tried to conclusion before the election. And it's a very strong case. As far as Florida, that's the most open and shut case. And I am a huge admirer of Jack Smith, but he could have brought that case in D.C. And Larry Tribe and I said so more than once in op-eds before he brought the case. And that would have eliminated the problem that we have now with Eileen Cannon.
Right, but the Manhattan case is the only game in town, and you say it's a strong case. And give us your arguments against the law professor at Boston University, Judge Sugarman's arguments in an essay in the New York Times.
That essay infuriated me as a prosecutor, a former prosecutor, Ian. Essentially, what he said was that the case is not strong. It's a historic mistake, he said. And he also said that it's an embarrassment of prosecutorial ethics. All those things are dead wrong. The reason he said these things is that there is no precedent squarely on point in the case. Oh, really? There's no precedent for a presidential candidate buying a story, having people, his co-conspirators, buy up a story so it wouldn't appear before the election? There's no precedent. There are so many precedents that come right up to the edge of the current situation. It is no problem at all for any sensible court to extend those precedents to this case. And that is exactly how the law is built, by extending from one situation the same kind of reasoning to the next situation that appears. And this is the part that infuriates me. If you are a rule of law prosecutor, that's exactly what you do. He seems to be saying, oh, there's this risk that he could lose on appeal, that Brad could lose on appeal. But if you are afraid of a small risk of losing on appeal, because on every one of these issues, the trial judge, Judge Juan Merchan, has ruled for the prosecutor. If you are afraid, you would not be holding anybody to account. And as you said, Ian, this is the only game in town because Bragg had the courage to say, I am holding Donald Trump to account for what he did in getting himself elected, an election that has changed the course of history and put us in the situation we're in right now.
Well, obviously, Sugarman's going to, if he didn't watch the testimony of David Pecker, he has to know that his whole argument is out the window now. And you write in your at the conclusion of your article at Salon, in the universe of threats to democracy, a candidate's intent to defraud voters, if proven, is perhaps the most serious intent to defraud one can imagine. Trump is accused of seeking to deprive Americans through deceit of information most would have wanted to know about a candidate before deciding whether to make him president. The law is wise enough to take into account this element of a crime against democracy.
I sure hope so. It better be. Or we don't have a society.
Right. No, it couldn't be more serious. And you think, though, that the weight of, I mean, so far, my God, I thought the testimony against him from his friend, by the way, David Pecker, was devastating.
You're going to see that all the way through. You're going to see the defense lawyers poke a few holes here and there. But when it comes down to the final argument, and both sides say, use your common sense jurors are going to see the weight of the evidence, as you say, is overwhelming, that Trump was trying to unlawfully interfere with the 2016 election and with material facts that Americans wanted and needed to know. One can never predict what a jury is going to do. We don't know if there's a sleeper cell on that jury, some Trumpist. But we do know this, Ian. Every Trump-related case, criminal case, from Paul Manafort in 2017, 2018, I'm losing the name of, Peter Navarro, Trump's trade aide. He was just convicted of contempt of Congress. Every conviction, every case has resulted in a conviction. And in Manafort's case, you may remember this, there was a MAGA juror who left her hat in her car. And she said, I like Donald Trump, but I had to go along with the evidence. And I think that is what is going to happen, although one juror can hang everything up, and we'll just have to see. But the key point is, Bragg had the courage to hold Trump to account. He's sitting in a courtroom now where the judge is telling him, shut up and sit down when he stands up too early. And this is a form of accountability before the final form of accountability, which I do believe will happen, a conviction.
Right, and some of the optics that the jurors are seeing in that courtroom, for example, Trump's own secretary, long-serving secretary, Trump reached out to shake a hand and she refused to shake his hand. That's got to speak volumes, hasn't it?
Well, I wasn't sure I read that, or if some deputy sort of interfered, and I just wasn't sure. But I think what speaks to volumes is that Trump His brand is to try to dominate and bully. And he is under the court's control, the control of the rule of law. And that is making him very, very uncomfortable. He's trying to reassert his dominance in those statements he makes out of court. But inside the courtroom, the message is getting across to America that the law is king, not
Right.
Donald Trump.
Right. And finally, this guy that's been one step ahead of the sheriff all of his life is actually facing the law. So I thank you for joining us, Dennis. I appreciate it.
My great pleasure, and I'm hoping to be able to say at the end of this trial that the words that Donald Trump will be speaking are, "I fought the law, and the law won."
And again, I've been speaking with Dennis Aftergate, who's a former federal prosecutor and the chief assistant city attorney in San Francisco, who has won cases of significance in the United States Supreme Court and the California Supreme Court. He currently serves as counsel to lawyers defending democracy. And he has two articles at Salon, Underestimating Alvin Bragg's Case Against Donald Trump is a Historic Mistake, and SCOTUS Majority Abandons Conservative Principles to Mount Bizarre Defense of Trump's Immunity Claim. We're going to take a brief station break. So we're back looking into the elections underway in India, which is often referred to as the world's largest democracy, and look into a disturbing article in today's Washington Post. An assassination plot on American soil reveals a darker side of Modi's India. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Dr. Sumit Ganguly, who holds a Rabindranath Tagore Chair in Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University in Bloomington. His books include India Since 1980, India, Pakistan, and the Bomb, Debating Nuclear Stability in South Asia, and his latest book is The Oxford Handbook of India's National Security. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Sumit Ganguly.
Hello.
Well, thanks for joining us, Sumit. And as an expert on India's national security, how would you rate its national security, given that it has a prime minister who is now in the midst of an election, who's stirring up serious communal strife in a country where it has, which has a large Muslim minority population? And he is obviously a Hindu nationalist, and he is essentially attacking the core of modern India and its democracy, which is its pluralism and tolerance of its many cultures and languages and religions.
Well, there's no question about it that there is a serious threat to cultural and religious pluralism in India. And this has been evinced over the last 5 years since Modi came back for a second term. And minorities in a number of different ways have been marginalized in India. And this does not bode well for the future of this country, of the country, especially if these trends continue.
So, what I find disturbing about, and I mean, first of all, there's a really damaging and alarming article in today's Washington Post. An assassination plot on American soil reveals a darker side of Modi's India. And we certainly should talk about that. But what I find disturbing about Modi is, for example, that he doesn't do press conferences. That you know, the only time he actually had to face the press when he was at a White House meeting recently with Biden, where he had to take some questions, and you could see that he was incredibly uncomfortable and didn't feel that he had to answer to anybody. That is not how democratic leaders should behave.
Yes, he has been quite loath to hold press conferences. And this is somewhat ironic because he's certainly capable of giving extremely able and compelling stump speeches on the hustings when he's in election mode. But there has been a considerable reluctance on his part to subject himself to a press conference where there could be awkward or contentious questions. And that has frustrated many people, not only foreign journalists, but domestic journalists, and also Indian citizens who would like to see their prime minister respond to legitimate queries about governance.
So let's touch on the Washington Post article that I mentioned about India's intelligence services aggressively targeting Indian diaspora populations in Asia, Europe, and North America. That definitely crosses a line, undoubtedly, killing people on American soil, which kind of didn't that coincide with Modi's trip here? At least the preparations did, I believe.
Certainly, that's what the article alleges, that the preparations were underway even while Modi was being feted at the White House. I have two responses to these charges. I obviously these are rather disturbing charges, so one has to take them seriously, especially in light of the fact that the U.S. government or the U.S. Justice Department, more accurately, has indicted an Indian citizen who was in the Czech Republic and who apparently had tried to mastermind this effort to kill a Sikh dissident in New York City. So obviously, one has to take these charges very seriously. And the second thing is, these charges are especially disturbing because while states routinely carry out these kinds of clandestine activities on the soil of other countries, they generally avoid doing that in friendly countries. You can easily visualize Russia doing this, say, in the United Kingdom. And this is not a hypothetical. Russian agents have tried to kill members of the diaspora whom they have deemed to be too pesky or troublesome in the United Kingdom with varying levels of success. But that's in the context of a hostile relationship. But when you are cultivating a warm and cordial relationship with the United States to try and kill an American citizen on American soil, if there's any truth to these allegations, that I agree with you, not only crosses a line, it crosses multiple lines.
But still, you have everybody in the press and here in the United States and even the State Department talking about the world's largest democracy, celebrating India as the world's largest democracy. You've got Western bankers and the Silicon Valley types all flattering India and boosting India, etc. At the same time, you've got this repression of political opposition in India. You've got the fact that he won't talk to the press, and in fact he attacks the press, and only but for the Indian Supreme Court, which he's trying to get rid of the Supreme Court, just like Netanyahu is in Israel. There's a French journalist married to an Indian. She just had her Indian citizenship revoked. An Australian reporter had the same thing happen to her. And a British academic of Indian origin also was denied entry into India. So it's starting to look a lot more like Hungary than the world's great democracy.
Well, as I said at the very outset of this interview, there's little question in my mind that democracy is under duress in India, and the evidence that you cite is all very real. Just a small correction, the French woman was not an Indian citizen. She might have had what's called an OCI card, an overseas citizen of India, because she was married to an Indian citizen. But be that as it may, the cancellation of her work permit when she was a legitimate journalist does raise profound questions about India's commitment or continuing commitment to a free press and to open discussion. The similar plight that befell this Australian journalist of Indian origin. But as far as the United States is concerned, and the United States' willingness to shrug off these rather disturbing episodes, well, that does not come as a surprise to me. After all, President Biden had referred to Saudi prince who runs who's the de facto ruler of the country as a pariah. But he then went to Saudi Arabia and engaged in a fist bump with the same prince. So, you know, the U.S. has dealt with regimes which are infinitely more troubling and indeed downright squalid. So that the U.S. is overlooking the shortcomings of Indian democracy does not exactly come as a dramatic shock to me by any means. The need to court India, to have access to its markets, to get India to cooperate on various global regimes, to elicit India as a bulwark against the assertiveness of the People's Republic of China, trumps concerns about democracy and human rights. This would not be the first time that the U.S. has found itself in a cleft stick and made a choice that it deems best serves its national interests.
Exactly. That's realpolitik, where a nation acts according to its interests, whatever they may be, whoever may define them, as opposed to their ideals. And clearly, China's rise, many see India as a buffer against China's rise. But on the other hand, when you talk about what is the U.S. gets out of it, the U.S. has not been able to persuade Modi to change his support for Putin's regime, which is committing genocide in Ukraine and having attacked its neighbor. And India is a huge customer of discounted Russian oil, which is keeping Putin's war machine financed.
That is exactly right. I can't quarrel with that. In large part, it has to do with India's considerable dependence, even today, long after the Cold War ended, on Soviet and subsequently Russian weaponry. And India, while it's trying to diversify its defense acquisitions, it hasn't been able to completely wean itself off the pipeline of Soviet and subsequently Russian weaponry and appropriate spare parts. And that's one of the principal reasons India has been loath to criticize Russia's invasion of the Ukraine. Also, a number of key Indians in important foreign policy positions have this delusive hope that by not criticizing Putin, he will India can prevent the emergence of a closer strategic nexus between the PRC and Russia. I think this is a fool's errand. But that said, there are a number of people in New Delhi who believe that that India still wields enough influence or can wield enough influence over Russia by not overtly criticizing Russia for its invasion of the Ukraine, and thereby prevent a closer relationship between the PRC and Russia, the PRC being India's principal long-term adversary. That is also a factor. And third, cheap oil has enabled Modi in an election year to tame inflation to some degree. So I think all these three factors explain India's stance on this vitally important question in international affairs.
So, just in closing, Sumit, then let's turn back to the elections underway in India. There are reports that Modi is worried, and that's why he's stirring up resentment. And I don't know whether we're having any pogroms, but he was banned from the United States because of a pogrom that he stirred up in Gujarat some time back. So there are reports that he's worried. I don't know how well the opposition is doing, because haven't some members of the Congress party defected to Modi's BJP?
Yes, some a handful of members of the Congress party have indeed defected to the BJP, but nevertheless, Modi does not believe in leaving anything to chance, and hence he has sort of relentlessly gone after the political opposition, has caricatured things that key members of Congress have said. He has incarcerated two chief ministers. Who are the chief executives of particular states on charges of financial malfeasance? Obviously, I cannot speak to the veracity of these charges, but it is curious that these charges were leveled just on the eve of the election against two popular chief ministers. Also, the inordinate amount of heat. The heat wave that has gripped significant parts of India has depressed electoral turnout. And consequently, I think Modi is worried that this may affect the extent of his victory. I think it's highly likely that he'll still be victorious. But the question is by what margin? And that could obviously affect the functioning of Parliament and his party's standing in Parliament, and consequently, he has ramped up the rhetoric dramatically in the last few weeks.
So, just in closing, though, I just wanted to touch on Ukraine again, because of Modi's support for Putin, in the sense of buying discounted Russian oil. And as you say, he's part of the motive. It may be a fool's errand, but maybe by being nice to Putin, India will sort of stop the growing alliance between China and Russia. But there are a number of Indian mercenaries fighting along with Nepalese and Cuban soldiers fighting in Ukraine against the Ukrainians, and many of them were duped into going to the front. What do you know about that?
That is exactly right. A handful, I don't know about the Cubans, but that's entire stands to reason. But certainly, I know of Nepalese and Indians who were lured into Russia to fight against the Ukrainians, and they were lured by the promise of substantial sums of money, fairly decent living conditions. And it shows a level of desperation of young men, both in India and Nepal, that they would consider undertaking such a risky and potentially dangerous enterprise. And then, of course, discovering that many of these promises were not being kept, and frankly, they were being dragooned to the front. And now find themselves in rather desperate straits. But the mere fact that they chose to undertake this kind of a fraught enterprise suggests how acute the need for appropriate employment exists in India.
Right. And also how desperate the Russian military is to put bodies up on the front lines. So I thank you for joining us, Dr. Sumit Ganguly.
Thank you very much for this opportunity once again.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Sumit Ganguly, who holds the Rabindranath Tagore Chair in Indian Cultures and Civilizations at Indiana University. His books include India Since 1980, India, Pakistan and the Bomb, Debating Nuclear Stability in South Asia. And his latest book is The Oxford Handbook of India's National Security. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Evan Green to help us sustain this program into the future and ensure it remains free to all. Please take a moment to support us by going to backgroundbriefing.org/donate or publictruthmedia.org, where you will find our nonprofit Public Truth Media Foundation, where your tax-deductible donations, large and small, keep us broadcasting. And if you've missed any of today's programs or would like to explore our vast archives, you can find us at backgroundbriefing.org, where we include extended interviews searchable by topic and have made it easy for you to sign up for daily email updates that provide links to resources, articles, and books discussed on the program. Also, you can find links there to subscribe wherever you get your podcast, and we encourage your ratings and reviews on these platforms. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at Ian Masters Media. And please do help us reach more listeners by sharing this program with friends, family, and colleagues. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. The guy that lived next door in 305 took the kids to the park and disappeared by